everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for you today. My guest will be Roxanne Zimmer. She is a master gardener and professor at SUNY Stony Brook and is working for Cornell Cooperative Extension right now. And I will be introducing her in a little bit. But first, I want to share with you some things going on in the news, some ways you can take action, and of course, my weekly recipe. So first, in the news, Biden has come out with this new $2 trillion infrastructure plan that, of course, is getting a lot of pushback from the Republicans, but it is really right on the mark in so many ways. It really, is taking climate change into consideration in its decisions. It is supporting new technology for alternative forms of energy, wind and solar. It's moving us away from our dependence on fossil fuels. He's very much aware that millions of people are hungry, people are out of work, people do not have a guarantee to clean drinking water, and that our carbon emissions keep going up. And so his plan to improve public transportation, railway and bus service, and pivot us away from our dependence on fossil fuels towards alternative energy is really where we need to go. He's also, paying attention to the issue of systemic racism in our society and trying to address that the best he can with this plan. So it, touches on so many things that are important to me. And I really, hope we all can do our part also to wake up to climate change and do what we can to become involved citizens so that we can mitigate the problems with climate change. Of course, most of it has to be done through policy, but in our own small ways, we can make decisions that do have effects, like the foods we buy, supporting organic agriculture, supporting organic farmers and our health, doing what we can to keep ourselves healthy so that we're not dependent on drugs and the pharmaceutical companies, and, showing up for rallies or writing your Congress people. All these are steps that we can take as citizens, and we all need to really do what we can. NOFA New York, on that topic, NOFA New York is hiring an organic policy coordinator, which is such an important job. As a board member for NOFA New York, I've really seen the power of policy and how policy really makes change. And, for a long time, while the past administration was in, it was almost useless to try to change any policy in Washington, and we really needed to focus more on local policy. But now we actually have someone that's more supportive of climate change and what needs to happen. So we need policy on all levels. And Biden's administration is certainly working on policy on the national level, but we all need to work on policy also on the state and local level. So NOFA New York is looking to hire an organic policy coordinator that really can work with all of our members to really move policy in the direction that supports organic. As a school food coordinator for Glen Cove Public School, even though I've been on hiatus since COVID, I'm very passionate about school lunch programs. And I have seen that, right now there is a policy or an initiative to try to get school lunch administrators to purchase 30% of New York State produce in their lunch programs. And if you get to that 30% sweet point, you actually get a savings of 25% more money into your budget from the state. So it's a real incentive. But right now, the way policy is set up, our milk is coming from New Jersey, and we can't get milk from New York State. The milk is farmed in New York State, but then it's shipped to New Jersey for the packaging. And as a result, we can't use that to qualify for that initiative. So lots of things have to happen in policy to make things work smoother. And NOFA needs our help in finding that right person. So if anyone out there listening knows of someone that would be great as an organic policy coordinator, please go onto the NOFA website and take a look at that. And then I wanted to share with everyone this great article that was in the science section of the New York Times this past week, or this week, about Michael Moss's new book called Hooked. And this book is about junk food and processed food and its effects on our circuitry in our brain. And that causes us to overeat. And you have to understand that processed foods are actually not chefs cooking up processed food. These are scientists in labs trying to find that sweet point at where you become, where it triggers your brain so that you become addictive, but where they don't put too many ingredients in that are expensive. So they want to put as little cost into the quality of the food while getting you to be hooked on it. And it really, you know, it was shocking to read about not only the manipulation and the preventing of research from happening and manipulating internal documents, but I was shocked to find out that these food companies have been buying up diet companies since the 1980s. It's unbelievable. Heinz bought Weight Watchers, Unilever bought Slim Fast, and Nestle brought Jenny Craig. And there are others. But you know, these food companies are pushing processed foods so that we get addicted, so we get fat, and then they want to profit off of the diets that we all try to go on to stay thin. It's unbelievable. I just hate corporations. They're so corrupt. You know, their decisions are made based on greed and profit. And we really need to change that paradigm. We need to, you know, the bottom line is should not be the driving force. And, you know, a few weeks ago I had Doug Rao on about, he was the past president of Trader Joe's, and he was just talking about how the bottom line has to be good for all the stakeholders, not just the stockholders, but all the stakeholders. And the stakeholders always include the people and the land and the environment. There's so many stakeholders that are involved in decisions. It is not just profit, and we really need to figure out a better system. So anyway, check out that article. It was really mind-blowing to me. Ways you can take action, I have on my website a petition to sign on to this letter to John Mackey, who is the CEO of Whole Foods, to ask him to really try to be a leader and get some of this single-use plastic out of their market. I mean, Whole Foods is a role model of a healthy grocery store, and they're doing a lot of things right, but they also have, you know, lots of ways that they can improve. And one is to try to get foods where we can move towards bringing our own bags to put our lettuce in and our celery in and our carrots in. Do we really need all that plastic? And we need to find ways to reduce plastic, and we need to retrain our customers. We need to retrain the masses of people, and we are trainable. I mean, I remember, you know, we used to always pull into a gas station and people would pump our gas. We never got out of the car and pumped our own gas. And now everyone's used to pumping our own gas. We trained the public to pumping gas. I'm not happy about it. I'd much rather have someone pump it for me, but nevertheless, I know how to do it. I can do it, and I will do it. Yes, people might prefer to just pick up that box of lettuce, but we're all very capable of bringing a container of some sort and taking the tongs that are there and putting the lettuce into the bag. I mean, how difficult is it? We just have to retrain society. And so we need to move away from this single-use plastic. And we're asking Whole Foods to be a role model and to really take the lead in that. So please sign on to that. I also have a petition for the Biden administration to side with the people. The Dakota Access Pipeline has been something that I've been writing about for over a decade already. you know, we did manage to shut down the tar sands pipeline. And that was great. But the Dakota Access Pipeline is now in its third presidential administration. It, you know, runs through 1, 2, 3, 4 states in the country, going through indigenous land. And it is just not necessary. We do not need this oil. As a matter of fact, most of this oil is for export and for profit for the oil companies. It's not even for the use for us. We have plenty of it. So we really need to shut this down once and for all. They have not done an environmental impact study, an adequate one. That needs to be done. And they're actually operating right now without a permit. So for many reasons, we need to shut it down once and for all. So please, please sign on to that. And there's also a link on my website to a 21-day racial equity habit building challenge, which actually already started a few days ago on April 5th, but you still can join in. And this is just to take a look at how we all function and how racism affects so many of our decisions that we make. And very often it's not intentional. It's just a habit. It's the way that our society has been set up with institutional racism from the very beginning. And so very often we really need to take a look at racism beyond individual and interpersonal racism, really towards this institutional racism and how white supremacy patterns have been ruling so many decisions in our society for so long. So anyway, I know I've been doing some work with both my Slow Food board and with my NOFA board on looking at racism. And it's just something that as a white person, we all need to really start looking at so that we can really change that paradigm. So please take a look at that. And now I'd like to share with you my recipe this week. This is the last of my Passover recipes. I know we're past Passover, but I wanted to share this with you nevertheless. And these are vegan macaroons. Macaroons are something I really only eat once a year. But they are filled, my normal macaroons are filled with butter and sugar and eggs. And they're delicious, don't get me wrong. And I tell you the truth, I did even eat one because I did make a batch for so many people that requested them. But I transformed them into a vegan recipe and they really came out great. So I'm really happy to share this with you. And I've done vegan macaroons before that I've shared, but this is a new recipe and it works really well. And instead of sugar, I've used maple syrup. So it's a big improvement. So I start with 3 cups of coconut, and that's unsweetened shredded organic coconut, 1/4 cup of oat flour, 1/4 cup of almond flour. And the oat flour and almond flour I make myself. I just use my food processor. I put in my gluten-free organic oats and I just pulse it until it becomes a coarse flour. And the same with the almonds. I put in my almonds and I pulse those until they become a flour. 1 cup of coconut cream. And that just has a little bit more fat content than coconut milk. If you don't have it, you can use coconut milk, but the coconut cream is what I'm using as my oil, basically, instead of my butter. 1/2 cup of maple syrup, 2 tablespoons softened coconut oil, 3 teaspoons vanilla extract, and 1 teaspoon almond extract. So in a small bowl, I first combine the coconut cream, the coconut oil, the maple syrup, and only 2 teaspoons of the vanilla. I'm saving 1 teaspoon for later. In a separate bowl, I'm mixing the coconut, the almond flour, and the coconut flour together. Then I'm going to add those wet ingredients into the bowl of the dry ingredients and mix it well. Then divide that mixture in half, and half of it is going to become a vanilla macaroon that you can drizzle chocolate on, and half of it's going to become almond macaroons. So in the half that's going to become vanilla macaroons, add the extra teaspoon of vanilla extract to that. And for the bowl that's going to be almond macaroons, add 1 teaspoon of almond extract to that. And then you're going to line a cookie sheet with some parchment paper and spray it lightly with some coconut oil. And then I just place the macaroons. I take a handful of the macaroons, a small handful, and just place it down onto the cookie sheet, making little peaks with the dough and shaping it like a giant, you know, chocolate kiss, except a big one. And on the ones that are almonds, I put slivered almonds on the top so I can tell the difference between the almond ones and the vanilla ones. And I bake them at 325 for about 8 minutes. Then I reduce the heat to 250 and bake for another 8 minutes. And if your oven is hotter in the back, you might need to turn the cookie sheets halfway through. And then let them cool. And I drizzle some melted dark chocolate onto the vanilla ones. And I leave some plain vanilla, some chocolate drizzled, and then I have almond. And they're just delicious. You don't miss the butter, you don't miss the sugar, and you don't miss the eggs. So check it out. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest this week, Roxanne Zimmer. As I said, she's a master gardener and a community horticulturist at Cornell Cooperative Extension. And she's been spreading the word about best garden practices for many years to people in our community. And in her community horticulture role at Cornell Cooperative Extension in Suffolk County, Roxanne speaks to school and community groups about why we should be reducing lawn area, why we need to plant more native plants, and about growing more vegetables. She offers master gardener training classes and a spring gardening school every year. A recent initiative that she's leading is called Seed to Supper program, and that teaches those in greatest need how to increase their food security. I'm sure we'll be talking about that in a little bit when she comes on. Roxanne's offered courses on global food issues at SUNY Stony Brook, and she has been a part of a delegation of farmers through Canada, where they went to Cuba to examine food security there. And she's presented at national conferences for the American Horticulture Society and the American Community Garden Association. And so when she's not weeding, she can be found raising oysters at the Cornell Marine Program. So I'm so thrilled to have Roxanne on. Roxanne, are you with me?
I am. Yeah, nice to be here.
Thank you. So I thought we could really just start where you could share with us a little bit about your own personal history and story and how you came to love plants and teaching about plants.
Well, I guess I'd have to say that my mother hooked me. I was a young child and she introduced me to a peony flower. And there's nothing more exquisite than a peony. And so I was hooked on flowers. And then my dear grandmother had a very ambitious vegetable garden. And when I was a little kid, she would give me the hose and encourage me to water drip by drip by drip down the row on each plant. And so at a very early age, I took to the idea of the wonders that can come from wonderful soil, whether that's beautiful flowers or delicious and nutritious vegetables. And so then I have been interested in food in a way. And that led me to the graduate course that I'm over at Stony Brook in the School of Medicine, and then now the more recent position at Cornell Cooperative Extension, in which I do both the ornamental horticulture and we talk about food as well.
Mm-hmm. And so at Stony Brook right now, you're teaching a course on food, right, on global food issues. Can you tell us about that?
Right. So what I'm trying to do in that course, and it always amazes me how little students in the nutrition program know about food. And so my goal is to raise awareness about the foods that they're going to likely find on their plate, how they got there, and what do those cost in terms of potential environmental degradation, excessive water use, and then, of course, what they know most about and care most about is human health. And the two pieces that fall out when we look at the global food chain is obesity and diabetes, and how these are so connected to what we have constructed as a global food system. So to get students to understand all this, we need to get into the weeds. We talk about the international reach of major corporations involved in not raising food, but in agribusiness. We need to talk about food waste worldwide. we discussed the diminished voices of farmers in every country around the world and what they're doing to indeed make themselves heard around the globe. We also have to talk about how the Western diet has now become a favorite of people all around the world, in Africa, in the Middle East, in the Far East. And then, of course, we talk about what are called farm land grabs. You may know that there are countries who may not have particularly good soil who are reaching into South America or to Africa and actually buying up land and farming it for their countries and their corporations. So what's terrific about all of this is that most of these students are either working as dietitians, many of them will be working in the public health sector. So what my goal is that I recognize that these are the very students who will in some way be involved with the public sector. They'll be feeding people or advocating for different choices. So my hope is that they bring what they've learned in the course to whatever it is they're going to do in their professional lives.
Mm-hmm. When you teach them, I know you mentioned you're surprised how little they know. What surprises them most about what you're teaching them?
They are absolutely blown away by both the size and the scale of the corporate global food system. You know, maybe like the rest of us, they hold on to these idealized notions of the farmer. And no matter where you are in the world, there's some farmer nearby who's raising your meat or your food or your vegetables or your fruit. And what just absolutely takes them by surprise is the enormity of agribusiness. And then within that, how corporations reach and try to dominate. And indeed, you were talking about it in the context of others in your introduction about the greed. So we look at a lot of corporations, but I look at one in particular with them. And I say, you know, have you ever heard of the Nestle Corporation? And they will say something like, yeah, I see their name on the wrapper around Halloween time because they, you know, put out all of that chocolate candy. So I say, yeah, that's true. And then let me tell you some more about the corporation. So they're just, you know, almost flabbergasted by the infant formula marketing scandals worldwide in which Nestle was involved in. And as I'm sure many of your listeners know, you know, they would first offer formula for free in hospitals while women were breastfeeding, and then they would stop breastfeeding and then take the free formula. And then when women were no longer producing their own milk, then there was a fee for the infant formula. How women would pose as nurses outside hospitals, giving out these free samples. And then when the hospitals got wind of this and they would chase them away, the Nestle Corporation would have people actually walking around neighborhoods looking for diapers, hanging on the lines to know where they're at to target a mother who indeed they should sell more of their product to. So that's, you know, they had no knowledge about that. And then I said, well, does anybody here drink Poland Spring? And yeah, you know, we like bottled water. And then I talk about how involved Nestle has been in water mining. As your listeners know, Nestle has gone through many, many, many different states and actually taken the groundwater for virtually nothing. And indeed, they give it 51 different names. So you don't think it's the same company? They don't realize that Poland Spring is Nestle, that Deer Park is Nestle, that Ozarka is Nestle. Again, that was news to them. And then we talk about the more recent phenomena in which the Nestle company has been making inroads in barrios in South America. Very specifically, by selling packaged processed snacks door to door. Now, Nestle will boast that they're giving jobs to the young women who, you know, push these carts through neighborhoods. And yet these workers are taking precious money from people who can't get out to buy their own food, and they're buying something that's going to likely contribute to very poor health outcomes of obesity and diabetes. And so all of that is just like, you know, an eye opener for the students. Yeah. They didn't realize that Nestle is, if not perhaps the biggest world's food supplier.
Yeah. You know, it is, it's amazing when you try to, when you try to start connecting these dots and you see how deep they infiltrate. You know, one that has always made me skeptical of Cornell, for instance. I mean, Cornell gets so much funding from the likes of Monsanto. You know, the biotech companies actually give money to institutions to teach. And then, you know, there's conflict of interest. You know, I know there was a whole scandal in with Cornell getting money from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and, you know, in cahoots with the biotech companies so that the professors were teaching pro-GMO agriculture. Like they were supporting GMOs. You know, I actually have a thing, and I don't mean to put you on the spot. I know we didn't talk about this at all, but it just came up this morning. You know, where's the things that these are a few examples of what this one student heard in his class, that GMO food is necessary to feed the world. There is no instance of harm from agricultural GMOs. Glyphosate, the main ingredient in Roundup, is safer than coffee and table salt. The science of genetic engineering is well understood. If Rachel Carson was alive today, she would be pro-GMO. I mean, you know, you know, these are things that professors were saying to students at Cornell, you know,
I could just interject, I think it's true that every major university in America that has programs like this is, in fact, doing research for a variety of companies. I have the luxury of having the home and residential people in my wheelhouse. And so we recommend to homeowners, to those who are growing in their backyard or their front yard, that organic practices are the best and most appropriate for you to grow whatever it is you'd like to grow, whether that lovely rose bush or that delicious tomato that's going to come from your tomato plant. So that's, if you will, a very different place that I come from and that I support, because we're looking at the base of the homeowner. That's where my interest and my abilities lie.
Yeah.
I will say this to say about what surprises me about teaching is that usually by the end of the course, students will make a statement that says they say something like this: "You changed my whole experience of going food shopping. I can't just now walk down the aisles. I'm thinking about, did the farmers who grew those products get paid fairly? You know, or how many planes, buses, trucks, and whatever took those grapes from Chile to get to New York?" And then others will say, you know, "I just eat differently now." And one said to me, "I eat a banana with much greater awareness of its preciousness, you know, because the banana has labor issues, has transportation, has politics. And as you know, the Cavendish has biodiversity issues, disease pressure, and it's a story about climate change as well." So I'm just thrilled that then when students walk away from the course, they're taking this into their lives as well as perhaps their profession.
That's great. Absolutely. I mean, you know, that's, I feel so committed to education for that reason. You know, as the food coordinator in the public school, you know, I was giving samples of vegetables, but I didn't feel like I was getting to reach the students, you know? And so I actually started going into the health class, you know, and showing a little Sierra Club video, you know, it was like a 10-minute animated thing, but it touched on so many of these topics that you just addressed, of where our food comes from and the preciousness of it and the different issues revolving around it and making those dots for the, you know, connections for the students. And, you know, and I do hope it impacts them, you know, and that it's something that they take into their life and that they take home to their families and then into their communities and really think differently about what foods they eat and what foods they support and their health. I mean, you know, these companies, like I said in my introduction, where they're buying up diet companies. I mean, how horrible is that? You know, that they know that they're doing this destructive this destructive role to society, and then they want to profit on the other side of it as well. It's just, to me, so despicable, but so unsurprising. So you've been working for Cornell Cooperative Extension for 2 years now. Cornell, like extensions in every state of the U.S., they provide resources to the community they serve. Can you share with us what Cornell Extension does to address food concerns?
Right. So we have a number of my colleagues that talk about nutrition. They will, you know, do programs on superfoods. They will reach into schools and offer modules. And what's terrific about Cornell's in Suffolk, Extension in Suffolk, is that these are often offered in English as well as Spanish. There's a great deal of interest in the promoting and explaining the SNAP Ed New York. And my colleagues also work with small farmers, helping to distribute fresh vegetables to those communities that tend to be underserved. You know, and it's great. So we've got, you know, a good dozen or more people who are involved in or on the food front line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they were involved in trying to get some fresh vegetables into some of the bodegas.
Yes, and were successful, I believe, on the South Fork in doing so. I'm not sure. Was it Patchogue? But indeed, it's a tremendous effort.
Yeah, it's funny because here we were talking about Nestle. Years ago, I was at a conference and I met someone who was working for Nestle. And I actually thought, oh my God, what is Nestle doing at this food conference I'm at? And turns out he sold to Nestle the idea of distributing fresh fruits and vegetables to bodegas where they're delivering their soda and their, you know, their junk food. So, you know, while they're supplying all that other stuff, they already had the transportation in. And so as much as I was down on Nestle, and right, I am, I was happy to hear that they had this program. And very often, you know, I was on the Suffolk County Food Council when they were first piloting the program to bring some fresh vegetables into the bodega. And I have to tell you, Roxanne, it took a full year to get the vegetables into that one bodega. And then, you know, this guy through Nestle, he was able to, you know, get vegetables into a couple hundred bodegas, you know, within the year. And it was
that's wonderful. That's a silver lining in the cloud.
Yeah. I mean, it was just to show you, though, that, you know, because they have the infrastructure of right, the delivery and all that right, already set up, they were able to, you know, go and do that. So, so often, you know, the lines get blurry with these multinational corporations that we think so bad of, because on some level, sometimes in their attempt to kind of counter their bad reputation, they greenwash some sort of good program so that they don't look so bad to the public. And that's, you know, that's where they put their energy in their PR. So, you know, it's almost like you have to be an investigative journalist to really find out what's going on behind the scenes, because, you know, what we hear is not always accurate. You know, there's all this greenwashing going on everywhere. So going back to Cornell, in what ways do you address food concerns in your role as a master gardener?
Yeah, I have the pleasure of training the master gardeners, and the training is roughly the equivalent of a college course in terms of its duration and topics. We talk about the best regenerative practices around soil. It's organic. We talk about the role of compost and growing fruits and vegetables. Increasingly, I talk about the meaning of food security, and certainly during this pandemic, it was just so obvious. I show the documentary, which, you know, I'm sure, A Place at the Table, and how that dramatically reveals how hunger cuts across almost every community in this country, and showing how it's such a difficult and pernicious problem, but all the same, very important to address. So for many, this was the first time they've seen such a documentary, and it, you know, gives them ways to think about what they can do. So I asked them then to go into their own towns, their own communities, to see if they can understand that food need and what, if anything, is attempting to address it. And lo and behold, they say, hey, you know, I never knew it, but in the basement of my local library, they're giving away bagged lunches to school kids in the summer. Or that there were these caravans of drive-ins around my church or house of worship giving away food. So that was, you know, it's terrific for them to see how it's really in their own communities and to start thinking about how they might become more proactive. And how they do that? Well, they've got a master gardeners need to, as part of their training, volunteer at least 125 hours giving back to the community. So a couple of the master gardeners have actually launched community gardens. You know, a couple on the South Fork, a couple in western Suffolk County, and some on the East End. And then a good number of them find where there already is a community garden, perhaps in a public space, perhaps a township is running it, perhaps a house of worship is, and then they join the others there, planting, harvesting, and distributing. And they're more attracted to the community gardens where people grow to give, you know, so that anything grown there is going to a food pantry or other group like Island Harvest distributing the food.
Uh-huh. How many grow to give gardens are there? Do you know?
I know personally of at least 6 or 7, and I'm sure there are many more that are just popping up each season. So the one that I work with here, the Episcopal Diocese of Long Island has been very involved in starting a number of these on what are either church properties or donated properties. I'm near one here in the North Fork. A local farmer, Peter Treber, actually gave us some, a 50 by 100 piece of his farm to grow food that we exclusively donate either to his parish and or CAST, a group in an agency in Greenport that distributes food for people in that community. It's really, I think the growing to give garden is really where we all should be thinking if in fact we want to do something that makes a difference to that incredible need of people who don't know where their next meal is coming from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. Sharing the vegetables is, you know, a wonderful thing. And there's, you know, organizations that actually, if you're a home grower, you can, you know, look up and donate your vegetables to this organization that will find a food pantry where you can give it to. And, you know, it's, you know, you can always find a place to give away your vegetables. So if you have extra, anyone who's listening, who's growing, you know, connecting with a food pantry is a wonderful thing to do with your extra vegetables.
And I want to say, I want to underscore that, Bhavani, and I want to say, and maybe it all is only 5 onions and 3 tomatoes, but that makes a difference because even if you don't have like a big yard full of 5,000, you know, cucumbers, by all means, donate what you can because that is going someplace to someone who's delighted to have the 1 or 2 cucumbers or tomatoes.
Yeah. No, and no, the organization is called Ample Harvest, ampleharvest.org. That's the organization that has a whole connection of website to connect you with food pantries. So check them out, ampleharvest.org. So where are your Master Gardener classes taught? You know, do people come together in person or is it being done virtually now? How does that work?
Well, it's been done both ways. And I, as a classroom teacher, I prefer an in-class face-to-face experience because I get to know the master gardeners. We work together, they form subgroups, and then we can actually do various exercises and workshops and demos together. The pandemic obviously put an end to that. And so the most recent master gardener class was offered online. I made the programs and the speakers available. And we're trying to do the best that we can in recreating the conversation around the topics that are important to us. And I can't wait for that moment when we get the all clear, when we can get together and actually do more work as a community of master gardeners. So right now we are on hold, but I look forward to the point in time, maybe it's later this year, when we can actually have training in person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would think that you'd need some you know, especially for a master gardener, you need some opportunity to actually get your hands in the soil, right? To really kind of learn and to go through it and see what healthy soil feels like and smells like. I mean, there's a certain feel, touch to it. You know, it's a tactile thing.
Absolutely. And it, what's amazing is we talk about the color, the shape, the its texture, its friability. And once you put your hand in good soil, you know the difference.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have beds on my property that, you know, I have been nurturing to try to bring back because, you know, I don't even know what it was, but, you know, it was like red and very, very clayey and filled with ants. And it just, I mean, you never saw a worm in there. It was just, you know, horrible. And over the years, I've been adding compost and leaves and, you know, it's coming back. It's starting to get like my other beds where it's, you know, beautiful, smells delicious, dark, black soil. And, you know, I was digging in this week, cleaning out some of the weeds that always seem to pop up, you know, nothing else seems to come back, but the weeds do, getting the weeds out and just seeing all the life in the soil. I mean, so many worms and, you know, it just makes me so happy when I see all that life under there.
And so much of it is microscopic so that people don't understand that really teeming group of predators and prey that are doing wonders for the soil because, you know, they're so tiny, we can't see them. So we don't imagine they're there. And I always remind people, you know, if you have a teaspoonful of healthy soil, there are more microorganisms in there than there are people on Earth. You know,
really?
And I'm exaggerating. I said, no, that's true. If you have healthy soil. So one way we try to teach more people than just the master gardeners is Cornell Suffolk, Extension Suffolk has been offering to both Nassau and Suffolk libraries, hour long programs. So we've got them on how to start an organic vegetable garden. We had a very popular series this winter on winter seed sowing. And I encourage people, you don't need a greenhouse, you don't need a hoop house. All you need is to do is recycle some plastic containers and you can set your seed out and start growing early. We also talk about compost and so on. So what's great about this is the libraries in Nassau and Suffolk are very, very generous in that they will make their presentation open to anyone who contacts them for the link. You don't have to be a patron, for instance, at the Middle Country Library. As long as you request, you say you want to come to the Magic of Compost or Organic Vegetable Gardening. I think tonight is Organic Vegetable Gardening at the Port Jefferson Library. Those librarians are delighted to let you or admit you in. You don't have to be a patron. And so we were so successful last year, ironically, because of the pandemic, that we delivered presentations to over 13,000 people through Cornell Cooperative Extension Community Horticulture in Suffolk, because the libraries were delighted to have these programs about gardening online.
Oh, they had them online. I was just going to ask you
that.
So
they're live online Zoom programs. So it's a, you know, about a 50-minute presentation followed by Q&A. And the Q&A can go sometimes for as long as 25 or 30 minutes. You know, people have wonderful questions about, you know, well, what do I do with my tomato? What do I do with my cucumbers and so on?
So does Cornell save those Zoom courses and have them online so that people can check in at another time? So like if someone missed an organic gardening course that Cornell was offering, is there a way for them to have access to it now?
That's a great question. What we do is since we offer them typically so often, we'll say we're offering three organic vegetable gardening courses next week at these libraries. Please contact the library and join us again if you'd like to see them. So we are thinking about getting some kind of archive of material as well. But I do think right now, since we offer them so often, we haven't been doing that, but it's a good idea.
Mm-hmm. I know most of those courses, you know, at the libraries, you know, those are really geared for adults. Do
yes.
you do the same type of thing for children? Do you have programming for children?
I've had the pleasure of working with Slow Food East End for a number of years, and they recognized early on the value of helping teachers and school districts figure out their relationships to food. And so I was involved in helping establish school gardens. In addition, I would provide curriculum that the teachers would introduce in the classroom that spoke to garden-related projects that were core educational goals. And then I also would come to their classrooms as the guest speaker. And I have to tell you what fun it is, as you know, with the health classes, talking about seeds and soil and worms. And kids really get excited about this stuff. And then when they go out and grow the stuff, you know, they never liked kale before, but once they grow, they actually put the seed in the soil and it grows, they're like the biggest promoter of kale. You know, taste my kale and see how delicious it is. So that's been a great deal of fun with kids. So I had to now bring those insights to my Cornell Cooperative Extension role. I've developed a web page for school gardens. Teachers can go there and find resources, find grant money, find curriculum. There's a whole bunch of different curriculum approaches. And then if schools are interested, I try to troubleshoot, expand the garden perhaps, and then more importantly, figure out a way to get some of that school garden food, if possible, into the cafeteria so that it is indeed embraced by not just the kids going out into the garden, but by the whole school community. And sometimes, you know, that's very tricky. That takes years to actually happen because of the contractual arrangements, typically with the schools, as you know, working in Glen Cove. What we found as an interim works to have a salad day or bar or something that might be in the hall, may not necessarily be in the cafeteria, but it's a chance for people to come together around that which was grown in the school garden.
Mm-hmm. I know I've had lots of teachers ask me about school gardens and, you know, wanting some help, but frankly, they need to have someone in the school that's really willing to take it on, because at least that's what I found, because it is a full-time job, right? I mean, a school garden is not just something that you can kind of throw together and then ignore. You really need to take care of it.
Absolutely, Bhavani. And I will tell you, because I will be the person who will go into the principal's office and meet with a member of the principal and someone on the school board and make the case for why a teacher needs a after-school curriculum position to take on the school garden, because it represents an ongoing effort year-round. And indeed, most of the principals then are persuaded that this is valuable, that this is an asset. It's like another club. One of the schools I worked with was so successful that the after-school garden club, which was called, I think, Gardening Rangers, had 3/4 of the kids in the school participating. You know, so it became,
that's great.
Right. So it just became such a terrific, if you will, after-school extracurricular activity.
Right. Right. Because another question I always get is, you know, we don't do school gardens because who's going to take care of it in the summer, which, you know, is always the question that I'm asked. And, you know, if you have a garden club, you know, you kind of assign families a week, you know, or two right. families every week. And there's only, you know, 10 weeks over the summer. So it's not that difficult.
Or another way to approach it is think about what you're growing. Maybe you're not growing tomatoes and cucumbers, but rather planting more autumn squash in June and things that will be coming into their own in September when the students come back. Right. Yes, you need to have an irrigation system and someone needs to be weeding, but you might think differently about, well, maybe we'll just grow different things that will come to harvest in September, or running another garden in September with arugula and other lettuces that will indeed, you know, bloom and blossom.
Grow fast.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Good idea. So let's talk about the Seed to Supper effort that you've launched. Is that something that you're launching personally? Is that through Cornell Cooperative Extension? Just tell us about that.
Okay. So Seed to Supper is a nationwide program that started in Oregon, a number of years ago. And the specific goal was to teach people about gardening who were those who were at most or greatest risk for food insecurity. And so there are a couple of weeks of programs and workshops. And then Oregon has invited other, and it's mostly the state universities in other states, to adopt the program. And then Cornell has adopted it from Oregon. And then many different extensions throughout counties throughout the state of New York are involved. We're the only ones, I believe, on Long Island doing it. And so we're working with an agency in Greenport, the CAST group. And so we will offer gardening training in English and in Spanish with hands-on demonstrations. We talk to folks about what do they like to eat, and then we get the seeds and we'll grow them together. So the whole goal is not only to address food issues, but to provide some community building as well. And our hope is when and if we can find a community space, we will teach folks how they can grow more of their own. Now, the reality is many of these people who are food insecure don't own the backyards or front yards in which they reside. So we're teaching container gardening, how to grow food in wonderful cardboard, boxes, how to grow microgreens, how to grow those things that they can do that are somewhat, if you will, movable, and they need not worry that that's not their front or backyard that they are digging into to grow their food.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Whereas in other parts of the country, more people tend to have access to spaces, community spaces. It's less so on Long Island. And so we're working within that boundary, if you will, encouraging people to use, to drill holes in the bottom of buckets and indeed grow tomatoes and cucumbers in those.
Mm-hmm. At the beginning of the my intro, I was talking about policy and how policy changes things and, starting with local policy. Do you have any suggestions for people how to approach their local governments to try to find space, that open space where they actually could start a community garden? Because I think that is really, a key for many.
Right. I think that's the right way to approach this. And I think every municipality, whether a township or a town or a community, probably has some space that indeed could be turned over to the purposes of a community garden. And you don't need much space. If we've learned anything from the example in Europe, people growing in graveyards and in medians and in all sorts of places, that there are spaces that might be and could be made available to a group of interested folks. Much as with the school gardens, however, as you reminded me, you need somebody or a group of people on the ground who will take it. So a township can't say, we're going to put a community garden here. There needs first to be that grassroots interest on the part of the people who live in that locale to say, we want this and we're going to take it the next two or three steps. Please think about providing us this access to this property. Mm-hmm. It's also true that I think many houses of worship are looking at front and backyard spaces that they have and donating them to the community.
Yeah, I think approaching houses of worship is a great thing because you're right. They do have the property and they're just lawns. And for so many of them, they have a commitment to public service and to serving the community at which they reside. And so I think approaching places of worship very often is a great, great way. I also am a big promoter of...
It may be more easily accessible than a township or a town or a county. You just may get started sooner going to a local house of worship with members of that community who might be interested in getting it off the ground.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're in an urban setting, I just want to say that you do need to check the soil. If you're in an urban setting where there could be some lead contamination or stuff like that.
Well,
in
or
which
it could
case
be any,
you would
any...
have to work with raised beds.
Right. I was just going to say, and do take your model or your lessons from any of the urban growers in which they usually put some kind of barrier down on what is the top layer of the soil and then build the garden up. And that's just such a good idea for all of us, especially on Long Island. We have a pretty shallow layer of topsoil that we should be making raised beds, that we should be putting stuff on top rather than tilling. We want to get away from tilling away from disturbing the soil, build up instead of digging down. And then particularly in potentially compromised areas, we want to make sure that none of those contaminants are being pulled up by the plants that we're then in fact eating.
Mm-hmm. Good, you know, good and so suggestion.
Right, and so definitely get soil tested.
Mm-hmm. Where do you recommend people get soil tested?
Well, Cornell in Suffolk does pH testing. But to get a more full analysis, I know the Brooklyn College was doing, they have an urban soils lab. I just don't know, you know, where they are with the pandemic in terms of accepting samples. But that might be a place to go, Brooklyn College's urban soils lab. You know, and they're relatively close by.
Uh-huh. And you can do that through the mail, right? You just send a sample in and you get the report back.
Again, yes. And again, I would definitely contact them in advance to make sure, given the pandemic, they're doing the rate of testing that they need to. You know, and they'll mm-hmm. let you know how soon you're going to get results.
Good. So we're almost at the end of our session. I can't believe how fast it went. Can you, do you have any last final message that you'd like to share with my listeners?
Oh my goodness. You know, the message that I'm sure you hear over and over again from folks on your show, we all need to grow more of our own food. You know, this is the perfect time of year to putter in our garden, you know, and, you know, you may have a yard, you may have access to a community garden. And if you don't, think about alternatives, those containers, you know, boxes, buckets of some kind, because this is the season to begin, whether you've got seeds, or you're going to start with seedlings. Within the next 3 or 4 weeks, you really need to make those decisions and get going.
Thank you. What have you planted so far?
So I've got a Swiss chard that is starting to come up. I've got tomato seeds going. I've got cucumber seeds. And I'm going to try something that I've never grown before, collards. So I've got two different types of collards, and I want to give those a go. So, you know, I encourage everyone to try something new this year. You know, what have you never grown that might be fun to grow?
Collards are green. Great. One of my favorites are Mizuna greens. For those that don't know, yes. Mizuna greens, I love them. They're just so great, both in your salad and also just sauteed with some olive oil and garlic. They're yummy. They're baby mustard greens, really.
Yeah.
So I recommend trying those. Roxanne, thank you so much for joining me. It's been really informative, and you're doing great work. And thank you for teaching our young people. We need more people doing that. So thank you.
Always my pleasure. And thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And everyone out there who's been joining us, thank you so much for listening. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest has been Roxanne Zimmer, master gardener and expert at the Cornell Cooperative Extension in Suffolk. Thanks again. Bye for now. Have a great week. And I'll see you all again next week. Bye.